Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
To move on to something that was one of the reasons for the contact you at first, we had just two pals, Gordon and Enon, from the Founders Trail guys a few weeks ago. And the content of that, because I've probably done 2-3 podcasts just on it, and we spoke about the book. So that was when the contact you started, and probably did 2 hours on that alone. So when did you, were you working at the record when you?
I was working.
Just
at the
so
record.
Folk know.
No, I was working.
We're talking about the Gallant Pioneer book, which was written by Gary. When did you have the first one done?
2009. So this is the fourth or the fifth edition. Just because one of the things that I knew, because I was really keen when the first one was produced, that I made a point of saying, and there's some errors in the first one, none more so than saying that Tom Valance was related to Stanley Matthews, which isn't the case, although I understand that Tom Valance's descendants still think there is a link there. But anyway, so I always knew there was going to be mistakes. So, but that was just the nature of writing what we did. So that's why we've done. So this book, the 150th anniversary edition, I think is the closest that we'll get to the full truth about the history of the formation of Rangers. I decided to take it on as a project, and you'll maybe appreciate this. When you're a journalist, particularly a tabloid journalist, you're writing a lot of words a day, but very few of them stick. You're at press conferences, football games, you know, so you don't always get time to kind of stop and think and reflect and, oh, that was a good piece, because, you know, to paraphrase Pedro, the caravan moves on, eh? So so I always wanted to kind of leave some kind of legacy. And I like history, you know, I like football history. And it was just that the Rangers story, there's nothing as powerful as an idea whose time has come, right? And Rangers' story was there to be told. It needed research. It needed a lot of research. And I did that. I'm going to take Ian slightly to task here, right? But I'm going to caveat it by what I then go on to say. Because I met Ian and Gordon around about the 2006-7-8 period.
So you started your research?
I'd started my research. Helped with David Mason as well, yeah. That I was working with at the time. David did a lot of great work on William McBeath, for example, finding the story of William McBeath and how he ended up in Bristol in the southwest of England and his subsequent trial for fraud. That was David's work. But the majority of the work, you know, I can remember going to London, going to places like the Twickenham, the Rugby Museum, going to the National Archives at Kew, going to the Greenwich Village for Peter Campbell, going to the British Museum, going to all these places, going to Lincoln, up and down to Rosneath, all these just shoe leather stuff, right? Mitchell Library as well, graveyards, you know, saying to my 4-year-old son, listen, we're going to Craigton Cemetery today, and he's like, but I brought flowers for the McNeil grave because I just found out where it was. So probably about 75%, I would say, and yeah, he would say that anyway, 75% of that, the new research in that first book, 80% was my research, right? It was my research. However, the reason that Gordon and Ian's name is on this edition, this the latest edition, is because I doth my cap to no one more than Ian and Gordon in particular over the last 10 years for the work that they have done, not just in terms of the Founders Trail, but for the work that they have done on the history of Rangers, to the point where I think, and it's Gordon's research, I find it absolutely compelling, the argument that Rangers were formed in 1872 and went through a probably two or three names before, probably around about September 1873, having been known as the Club Western, decided to change their name to Rangers. My payback for this, because the reason that I struggled to get a publisher interested, right? There's no money in history, nobody's interested, right? And it, but I says that's garbage, you know. And a lot of people have fortunately picked up the book over the years. But the great thing for me was not long after, and by the way, I've got 1872, people think Gallant Pioneers 1872. 1872 had been written about, you know, many, many times before, not least by Robert McElroy and Bob Ferrier, you know, who, you know, in all the books that Robert had done, and Stephen Halliday as well had done a lot of work in the early years history, but Robert in particular, you know, 1872 was kind of, it had long been established. I just kind of brought it back to the fore again. And I remember Carol Patton. You remember Carol, who was the comms officer for Rangers for many years. She phoned me around about 2010 and says, Gary, a lovely story. She says, Sandy Jardine has decided that, or has put forward that, as a result, on the back of the book, that they change the formation of the club on the Govan stand, the Sandy Jardine stand, from 1873 to 1872 on the back of that, on the back of this book. But 1872 had been mentioned before. That wasn't the work of the Gallant Pioneers. But this, as I said, brought it to the fore. And so it was my thrill, and it will be forever my thrill. This is the one takeaway that I have got from it. And I took my boy to a game, and I said, listen, see up there? It says 1872. It says they changed that because you're old man's book. And that's something nice to say. And Ian's got the Edmiston Drive sign as well. Remember they were pulling down the houses in Edmiston Drive about 10, 15 years ago, right? Just across from the main stand, yeah, right? Behind the goal at the plastic pitch, yeah. And up there there was a sign, Edmiston Drive, and I noticed it was like a rotten tooth, the one last building there. I was at a game on a Saturday working, and I says, they're pulling that down. So I made a point, and up to off the record on the Monday, and then there was a couple of guys about, and I says to one of the guys, I pulled a score out of my pocket, and I says, listen, any chance of that nameplate up there at Edmiston Drive? And he looks at me, he says, of course. So he's up with the crowbar and jimmied it off, and I gave him 20 quid. He says, no, you don't have to give me that. I says, no, I do. There you go. I really appreciate that. Aye, no problem, mate. There you go. And so I walked away with a sign plate for Edmiston Drive that had stood up there for so many years. I told Ian Locke that story. You know Ian very well. Ian's a great Rangers historian, you know, and a great collector of memorabilia. But actually, I gave that to Ian McCall, got it all done up. So Ian's got that original sign of Edmiston Drive framed. I think it's in his house. But I gave it to him because the work that Ian and Gordon have done to keep alive the founding fathers of Rangers has just been tremendous. And the night that they helped to organise at Ibrox, not long after the book was published, with Heather and Doreen, who were Peter McNeil's granddaughters, it will long live with me. It was a great night celebrating the early years of the club.
So when did you get the inspiration, I'm going to do this?
I think it was just a desire, as I touched on earlier, to write something that was going to be lasting. And so it was a case of, give me a project, because you'll know, as journalists, we get approached all the time, going to write this book, going to write that book. Football players' autobiographies, unless they're exceptional, a Roy Keane or even like a Cascarino or a Pirlo, something that takes you out the ordinary, they're fairly formulaic. And truth be told, I don't really find a lot of them a great read, you know. It's, you know, and then I run my trousers up the flagpole of the hotel night before a cup final, all that stuff, right? So I wanted to do something that would last. I wanted to have something that in 100 years, I'm not being funny, when I'm long gone, somebody will look at that and say, oh, Gary, I wonder who he was. So it was an ego thing, right? But if you've not got an ego, you're a wino, as I've long said. And so I just, chapter by chapter, character by character, I just decided to see how far I could get, as I said originally, with great help from David Mason, on finding the story behind the kids
with Rangers. About what?
2006, probably, 2005, 2006.
You've started your research. They two, bizarrely, met each other in strange circumstances. So how did you...
I remember the first time I met Ian, he phoned me, and I was... Football historians are a peculiar bunch, right? See, until you get to know somebody, you're not really wanting to share what you know, because you never know what's, yeah, you know, somebody's going to run away, and, you know, you've worked... It's human nature. You've worked so hard, and you've not quite revealed what you're wanting yet found, because you're writing that book. So you know what, and this is kind of just about pre-social media age as well, but the last thing you want is to go and tell somebody something and then they put it up on social media and say, oh, I can reveal that, you know, the McNeils are, you know, this, that, and the next thing. So Ian had contacted me, and we just had a wee chat, and I says, I like the cut of this guy's jib, you know. Sorry, I like where he's coming from.
What you were doing at the time, did they know you were...
Aye, they kind of, they did, for whatever reason, I think they probably did, and, you know, and I can't quite remember, but I do remember saying to Ian, okay, I'll show you some of what I've got, right, because you sound like a good guy. And so I did, and I remember taking them up to, and it's now a major part of the tour, and I says, right, I'll meet you at the McNeil's grave. And he's like, great, where is it? I says, it's at Craigdon Cemetery. We'll walk there, and I'll show you where it is. And so we went up there and we had a chat, and I've kind of said, so don't get me wrong, Graham and Gordon contributed quite a lot to the first book, you know. They were but I'd been up and down in London, and, you know, Twickenham, and to find out Alcock's annuals, you know, as I said, the Maritime Museum, to find out the records for the, you know, for Peter Campbell, find it left from Penarth Docks, find the name of the SS Columba, all that kind of stuff, St. Columba, all that kind of stuff. But as I said, in the last 10 years, Gordon and Ian's research has been exceptional. And that's why their names are on the front of the 150th anniversary, because no one deserves it more.
Yeah. So, and this is what I think. It's just bizarre with the whole Rangers story. There's a lot of things that just seem to happen, and you might not comprehend exactly why or where or whatever. But you three years ended up together, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then, so the first book came out 08, did you say?
09.
09. And then the last one came out last year. Mm-hmm. So how much has it changed from edition one to edition four? What sort of percentage of the books new stuff?
I don't think at heart it's changed, right? But every edition that we've done, and we felt it was important to do an 150th anniversary edition for obvious reasons, right? And it's still to my... I still think we should have organised a sponsor's walk or a jog or something like that around Kelvin Grove Park in the February of 2022. That's a kind of regret of mine. I would like to have done something about that, but anyway, time moves on. So I think that there's probably maybe about 20% of the book has changed, just that as new research has become available. And stuff has to be rewritten, and, you know, you become aware of wee facts, and you know the William McBeath picture comes to the fore. I still think it's incredible, Craig, that in 2023 that we still, as far as I know, I've not checked with our niece Val, but we've still got Doreen Holland, who's 94 years old and lives in Sussex. She's the granddaughter of Peter McNeil, the founder of Rangers Football Club. The granddaughter of a founder of Rangers Football Club is still alive. And that's astonishing. And again, I've got to tip my hat to Jeff Holmes. You know Jeff, who's done a lot of work in Rangers.
Jeff, very well, yeah.
Jeff's a great guy. I tracked down Peter McNeil's granddaughters, and I managed through my research, and I got them. And I phoned them, and I said, blah, 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 and smashing. And then a couple of weeks later, and it was only a couple of weeks, I think it was Heather that phoned me and says, Gary, I've had somebody on the phone say that they're a Rangers historian. They've managed to track me down as well, and it was Jeff. So Jeff was kind of work. So I says, come on, and it was kind of like first come, first serve. Jeff knew the project I was involved in. He was like, no, Gary, I'm not going to do anything with it. He's yours. So I owe Jeff a debt of gratitude as well, you know.
Another local boy. quote here.
Aye. Jeff's a good sort. So I really, really appreciated that. And you know, but as I said, Gordon and Ian pushing for things like the commemoration at the Glasgow Green, you know, pushing for the plaque at Penarth, the magnificent work of the Rangers, the grave restorations as well. It's wonderful work. And as I said, Gordon's research, first of all, in identifying a picture, a line drawn picture of William Macbeth, from which we could then reference the actual picture itself. It's marvellous, and I just hope with the opening of the new museum imminent and about to happen, I just hope that, you know, that these guys are given their, you know, are given a bit of recognition for the work that they do. You know, because I think that as well as Player of the Year awards, it's long been a opinion of mine that Rangers should organise a kind of supporters of the year or supporters that have contributed, and Gordon and Ian would be right up there for me for the work that they have done to remind people of the real reason for the formation of Rangers Football Club.
So you started writing this book 4 or 5 years in research, and I'd imagine, being a journalist and having that inquisitive mind, your research would have started before it even officially started. How did that happen? So out of all the sort of bits of information you found, what was the nugget for you? What was the jewel in the crown? What was the thing that you remember that you think was the most interesting?
I think it was, the way I approached it is you've got five guys, because you never...
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
In fact, Tom Valance is arguably as important as Peter McNeil, Moses, and Peter Campbell. Sadly, with his death, and William disappeared off the scene. So, you know, Tom Valance can't be his role, although he wasn't there in February or March 1872. Don't ever please underestimate his thing. So his contribution. So it was a case of taking each character, and it was just trying to kind of build a jigsaw piece by piece by piece. Historical research is fascinating because you get a wee glimmer or something, you maybe get a wee date that coincides with this or a wee date that coincides with that. I remember finding a census that showed that William Macbeth lived in the same close as the McNeil brothers, and suddenly you're thinking, ah, so that's the connection, that's how they knew each other. Rangers, the first game was against Callander. Ah, William Macbeth. Out to Callander, out to the Waverley Hotel, found out actually local historians out there were great, went to visit the grave of his mother and his father, which is still out there, obviously, in the old graveyard, was told that Ken Stott, you know, who played Rebus the actor, although he's a big jambo, he's actually got a distant relation through William Macbeth as well. So I always mean that if I ever see Ken Stott, I'm going to tell him he's supporting the Rang team, he should be a Rangers man, because he's related to one of the founders. There was wee bits like that. Finding, you know, going down to the Maritime Museum, finding what you think are the documents you need, getting them sent to you, opening them up, and finding things like a big log from the St. Columba with Peter Campbell's name on it and scored out from 1883, deceased, you know, drowned at sea. Things like that, that suddenly... then you just start to build a picture. William Macbeth's going down to Lincoln, finding out the poor house that he lived at, finding out the streets that he lived in, finding out ultimately where he was buried. Things like that. They gave a great degree of professional pride, but they were also kind of heartbreaking as well. But you hope that in bringing this to the fore again, you would remind people just about the young boys. It was how young they were. Just, you know, 15 years old, and they decided to start a football team, you know. Stuart McDonald, the House of Fraser, you know, John Stewart, giving them their first ball, you know, the links with, you know, even the links with Glasgow, you know, swinish inebriation, foul drunkenness in every corner. This is historians writing about Glasgow in the 1870s. You know, just as equally can apply to 2023, you know, 50,000 drunks and arrests for drunkenness every year in Glasgow in that period is probably the same now. The reason that we call the word for being drunk in Glasgow steaming is because it's got Peter Campbell's family and extended friends who used to run the steamers up and down from the Broomie Law up and down to the Gear Lock and places like that on a Sunday, because you were drink was forbidden to be drinking a Sunday.
So everybody would go.
So you wanted to go for a bevy with your mate on a Sunday, you had to go on the steamboats and go to Rue or go to, you know, wherever it may well be, Rothsay. And you just basically get steaming, and it comes to steamboats, and Peter Campbell's family were all linked with that as well, you know. Well, see, chapping on a woman's door in Clinda, and to have her say, I remember Moses from when I was a wee lassie. Now, that woman will be long gone now, you know. The McGrowther brothers who ran the boatyard down in Kilcreggan as well, those guys will be gone now as well, sadly. But they all remembered Moses when he was a wee boy. So you felt that you were just getting there in time, because these people were in their late 80s, 90s. So you're just getting there in time, you know.
No, I think, listening to you, all those things, interesting things that you've been in, things that you're trying to uncover. I think it's actually pretty amazing when you're saying that started in 2004, and by 2009 that thing was printed.
It's probably about 2005. Listen, I've got the divorce. I've got the divorce papers to show to show it as well. Sorry, Laura. But it was. You know what it's like when you're inspired to do something, and you're inspired to make a contribution, you're inspired to. It's every journalist craves words of affirmation, every journalist craves an acknowledgement for the work that they do, and that you don't always get that when you're writing a preview for a Dundee versus Motherwell match on a Saturday. But if you can turn around at the end and say, listen, do you know what, I wrote that, it's a kind of physical, tangible evidence of something that you've contributed to, and contributed to, I hope, the narrative of the formation of Rangers. You know, I hope that this book, not just with my efforts, but with Robert McElroy, with David Masons, with Robert Ferrier, with particular Gordon and Ian McCall, that people in years to come will look on this book the way that they did John Allen's books, and maybe think that it is a wee bit more historical rigor than John Allen's books as well. I hope so.
No, I certainly think that off to you, because just listening to you, you had to go to Twickenham, you had to go down to the Maritime stuff, you had to cram all that in and write it and get it published. And so that's actually a short period.
Really short period. But there was a motivation there.
But you're just still doing a full time job.
Still doing a full time job. So you're doing it at nights. You're doing it. You know, you're taking your days off. You know, you've got a new kid. You know, wee Lewis was, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old, whatever my boy's age was at the time as well. But it was an important story, Craig. You know, it was a story that needed to be told. And sometimes that's the most powerful motivation of all. It was a story that needed to be told. Yes, there's ego involved, right? You want to be the first to tell this story, but it's a great story. It's a great story that deserved to be told as well. I think
a lot of people spend their life trying to amalgamate money, but the actual driver isn't to put more digits in their bank. What they're trying to create is a legacy, so that they're no longer here. Somebody remembers them as that guy that done X, Y, and Z with their money. But there's not that many people in life that actually they put a legacy. That's a legacy, whether you like it or not. And you're right. In 100 years' time, people will pick that book up, or the digital form that it takes, whatever, you know, to make press a button and the whole thing goes in a 3D thing in their coffee table in 60 years' time, and it will be this Gary Ralston wrote this. This Gary Ralston put this together. So I don't know if that, you know, you're saying, you know, there was an ego and stuff, but you've actually created your legacy with that work?
It was difficult in as much as Rangers were one of the first clubs in Scottish football. I know that clubs came and went and they rose in Queen's Park, you know, hats off to them, 1867. But Queen's Park had a very kind of in-depth history written in 1917 in their first 50 years. You know, the Allen one in 1922 was probably, you know, was, as I said, it was less, less historically, what's the word, incisive. But Rangers being formed in 1870, always admired Campbell and Woods, Pat Campbell and Tom Woods, the book that they wrote for Celtic and Celtic's anniversary in 1888, which is they say themselves it's never been challenged. Celtic formed November 1887, you know, in the church in East End of Glasgow, but always admired that book. But it was difficult to bring that kind of historical rigour to a Rangers book simply because in 1872, the media, the newspapers weren't as advanced. You know, Scottish football was still in a kind of primitive soup, so people weren't particularly writing about Scottish football in the newspapers. There was a lot of cricket and so on and so forth, you know, and a lot of rowing and things like that, but not a lot about football. So Rangers was very, very difficult book to research. And I know that Ian and Gordon said, and rightly so, the internet helps. You know, when you can go into Scotland's people and start looking online at birth certificates, death certificates, marriage certificates. But, you know, but you've also got to go and do the hard yards as well, you know, and go into those dusty archives and what have you, you know.
There's still going to be a certain degree of that, but the internet will help. I mean, if you're writing that book today, would it have been easier?
Possibly. Listen, I make no claims that every single word in this book is historically accurate. They're as historically accurate as we can make them be. There's a part of me thinks that, I hope that in 5 or 10 years' time, some young guy comes along and says, you know what, Gary Ralston, your book's garbage, and here's the reason why, right?
Maybe
a paragraph, all right, maybe a sentence. But do you know what I mean? Because if it inspires younger people to come along, younger people, listen to me, sound like Methuselah. But if it inspires others to come along and say, do you know what, this is an area of Scottish football and the area of Rangers that really needs to be examined. And maybe there's always barnyard finds, you know. Maybe somebody will come in and say, listen, I've got this white shirt. And it might be from 1877. And by the way, that's not a light blue star out there. It really annoys me that people think that's a light blue star.
How could you say that without any colour?
Exactly.
If you find out that it was a Rowan Club's badge or something, we can then find out if that Rowan Club's colours
the Rowan Club was Clyde, was it Clydesdale? Clyde Rowan Club. So their badge was that colour. But, you know, but again, is that kind of assumption. Maybe it is light blue. I don't know. But as I say, maybe there'll be barnyard finds. Maybe somebody will go up to their attic and find one of the most heartbreaking stories I ever wrote was I did an interview once with the grandson or great-grandson of a guy called David Danskin, who came from Burnt Island, and David Danskin formed Arsenal Football Club, right? He was a munitions guy, went down to Woolwich and Woolwich Arsenal. So David, and we plucked him in Burnt Island where he was brought up, and he formed Arsenal. And his great-grandson said that to his great-grandfather's great annoyance, heartbreak, during the Second World War, he was living in Coventry. Munitions had moved him around the country, and he had a big, huge chest full of Arsenal memorabilia going all the way back. It must have been things like minute books and shirts and, you know, all these things, photographs, and they were bombed out the house one night, so they all went to the air raid shelters. He says, and when he came back, the house had been looted and it had been gone. And so all that Arsenal history, you know, and there's a wee part of the romantic side of me says that that's buried somewhere. And maybe, just maybe, it's unlikely, I know, but maybe, just maybe, there's a medal, there's a book, there's a whatever there is that features that 1877 shirt that's got that first ball, whatever. I don't know.
I mean, anything's possible through time. But again, back to your book, I'm not a great reader. I don't like fiction. Any books that I've actually read in the past have been, when I say about historical things, maybe JFK, that gets your attention, or autobiographies, not just all football players. They get my attention because they're full of stories. But I had that book for years before I read it, because I thought it's going to be, and on 1872 and the 3rd of March, we play it right, and just fact and dates and facts and dates. I can remember all the stories about history when I was at school. I can't remember the dates because the stories were of interest to me. And I remember I got the book as a gift, and it sat because I thought, I remember going like that, and it's all dates. And I didn't read it for years. But then when I read it, it was a story jumping out the page at me.
That's really kind of you to say, because it was important for me as an author. as an author, I feel like that. It was that Ford Kiernan chewing the fat character, you know, with a hat on. I feel as if I should fling a scarf across my shoulders here. Now, as an author,
Ronald de Villiers.
I feel like as an author. It was important that we helped to bring the guys back to life. But it was also important to me to show the formation of Rangers against the backdrop of Glasgow growing as a city in the late 19th century. And it was also important to me to show that you know, the only thing new in life is a history you didn't already know. Football players in the 1870s and 1880s were rascals, absolute rascals, you know. Rangers players were in that Athol Arms, which is kind of like the entry of where the subway is at Queen Street, you know, Buchanan Street, when you come out the side of Queen Street and go down, you know, just kind of sat there. You know, they were in there getting buried all the time. Queen's Park were great professionals as well, the great amateurs, rather. They were the same, all the team. One of my favourite stories is Dumbarton won the Scottish Cup, and they all went down to Loch Lomond on the bevy. And when they're coming back up for Loch Lomond, they're going through Vale of Leven, right? And they're all singing and bawling. This is 1884, right? Or whenever it was, Dumbarton won the Scottish Cup. And they're all with their wives and all that, all right? And they're in two or three of these kind of wagon things, you know, that I mean. And the Vale of Leven punters, Vale of Leven being a real stronghold of football, they've got buckets of slaughterhouse blood. And they've thrown them out of the players and their wives when they're going through Vale of Leven High Street, you know, and a rammy ensued. So, you know, there's, you know, fights with the crowd. And that's why, you know, Tom Valance said when first Ibrox was opened in 1887, you know, that really, you know, Rangers were the victims of the kind of circumstance of where they could afford to pitch their grounds. So Kinning Park in the 1880s was no place for the faint-hearted. You know, it used to be a kind of hallowed cricket ground for Clydesdale or whoever it was, but it was a rough and ready community. So Rangers fans have never been navel gazers. You know, Rangers fans, you know, they're white working class, or at that time, white working class, you know, Protestant, you know, grafters, if you like. They're no ones for poetry and literature, and that's kind of reflected and has always been reflected in maybe some of the character of the Rangers support, given that where the club come from and where the club draws its support, while acknowledging and embracing the fact that the club, like many others in society, you know, develops and matures as the years go on.
I think that it's a fine line for just football, for any organisation, for anything, anybody. You've got to be respectful of your past. If you can't celebrate it, it's kind of difficult. And then you've always got to remember you're heading in the future, and things change, times change. You know, signing Maurice Johnson was one of the things I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, and the world continually evolves. But maybe it's because I'm getting older, I just find it harder. You know, there's that line of, when do we stop celebrating the past? When do we have to embrace everything that's coming in front of us? And where can the two meet? No, I'm not suggesting for a minute we should be having the first team taught the words of the Billy Boys and all the add-ons. But things like this, things like the Founders Trail, things like hopefully the museum, can assure that future generations will remember the things that are important. Now, I don't think you saying, you know, we're a Protestant club then, that was because that Kinning Park area would have been Protestant at the time. You know what I mean? But there'll be people who pick up on that sort of stuff and go, ah, there's Gary Ralston saying Rangers are a Protestant club. But Rangers were a Protestant club, but not now.
The ethos of the club. That's where they drew the majority of their support from. You know, that that community, which was, you know, predominantly working class. And although, in fairness, the Mealy brothers used to go and watch Rangers at Glasgow Green. You know that Tom Mealy admitted that, revealed that in a piece that he did for one of the papers. It's in the book here in the 1920s. You know that they used to enjoy going down to Glasgow Green. But what I just think that Rangers at that time, particularly after the formation of Celtic, who were the club for the Catholic population in and around Glasgow, that was Celtic's community in the way that it was for Hibs in the yeah. East as well. There's nothing controversial in saying that. But I do think that, and I take it back to one of the things that I quite enjoy about the watching the women's team as well, because I think that if you've got any for new generations, and Rangers are in the envious position now where their season tickets are sold out now 9-10 years in a row or whatever it is, and I go and watch the women's team, and what I see there is I see a lot of young dads and I see a lot of girls, and there's more and more, and I include myself in that as well, with my daughter, and there's more and more guys are going there with their kids, And they're embracing, it's a new generation of Rangers fans. You know, it's a new generation. And I think that's great. You know, I hear what you say, right? Rangers are Rangers, Celtic are Celtic. You know, you can criticise the past, you can criticise the songs that were sung, you can criticise all that, but you can also acknowledge that we're living in a moving towards a new era, yeah. I hope, but nobody's going to come out and start singing Kumbaya, but where you have a population and a support, whatever that support is, whatever the club is, that's kind of, you know, embraces life as it is in the 2023 and doesn't hark back 50, 60, 70 years to a period where, you know, and you look at Northern Ireland, for example, where people are trying to move on from those wretched times of the Troubles.
Yeah, and funny you say, I was talking to a pal of mine who was born over there during the Troubles, and I said to him, see, when you were 10, 50, 15 years old, do you think it would ever end? And he was like, never in my life. Never in my lifetime thought it would end. But going back to Rangers, I mean, I've heard it said before that because Rangers had a 15-year start and they were originally playing in Glasgow Green. There is not a hope, there's no anybody could tell you any other than at that time, if there was people going to watch Rangers, there would have been a mixed community. And potentially, because of where it was in the demographic of that area at the time, there would have been Irish Dysphoria, RCs there, and that they would have just supported this club.
Just football fans. Football, there was a craze for association football, and I agree entirely with you. The whole kind of, we're getting into kind of different chartered waters here, but the whole thing about the religion and the context of Rangers and Celtic, for me, it kind of starts to become prevalent around about the kind of 1910 to 1920s period, and there's never really been a lot done in the research of that. I think it's got probably a lot to do with kind of British nationalism versus Irish nationalism and identities and so on, particularly around the First World War. I don't know enough about it to espouse any more of a theory than that. But up until then, I mean, you Rangers and Celtic fans, you know, uniting for Hampden riots when the SFA tried to stiff them in the, you know, the early 1900s
to have another replay
in the Scottish Cup, you know. So something changed. Rangers, you know, went and sent a team to play the first game against Celtic, you know. So something changed, and I think it changed around about that 1910.
But both clubs, nobody can argue that both clubs didn't benefit from it. And even to this day, particularly more Rangers, Celtic seem more comfortable talking about their heritage and the founders and, you know, the Irishness of the club. Rangers, I always feel, don't really know where the line should be, what we can hold and what we can't. But, you know, Celtic will bring out a third strip and it's got tricolour in there, and Rangers will bring out, surprisingly, around about the 12th of July, another orange strip. So both clubs do market it slightly different ways. But I do feel sometimes Rangers feel, especially the Britishness thing, there's loads of things about the DNA of Rangers fan. you can grab onto and celebrate without being abused of sectarianism. And I'd like to see Rangers do that a wee bit more, to be fair. But if there wasn't this thing, I mean, you go back to the turn of the century, there was probably no bigger different crowds between Rangers, Celtic and Third Lanark, right? The Third Lanark are not a team anymore. Well, they're a kids' football team now. That, I know a few guys that start reformed that. But something made Rangers and Celtic the driving teams in Glasgow, and there's been two dozen teams that could have been those teams, but it ended up Rangers and Celtic. And I don't think you could ignore and say it probably was driven by not sectarianism, people hating each other. People want to celebrate their own. Like, oh, we're all Protestants together. And it's fine. As long as you don't start throwing balls at each other, then you can have people in different camps. And then, you know, and I'm not saying that Rangers were a Protestant-only club for a while. I think Celtic would have been the same for a while, particularly when they started. They were started by the RC Church. I don't think there would have been a lot of invitations for Protestants to join them in their committees. And you know, those things don't last any longer. But it'd be interesting to find out where it started. But do you think it's fair to say that if it wasn't for that, they would have been the Third Lanners? Was that the difference between the Third Lanners, the Queen's Parks as well, to a certain degree, who had a head start in them all? Suddenly Rangers and Celtic became these two driving forces, and why was it?
I think probably the failure of Queen's Park to embrace professionalism when the Scottish League first started in 1890 gave Rangers an opportunity. And you've got to give the Rangers committees, George Goudie had to give them 30 quid, I think, about 1883 to keep the club afloat. But there was so much hard work going on in the committees by people like Peter McNeil that, you know, by 1887, Rangers have moved to the first Ibrox Park. By 1899, they're moving further up the street into Ibrox Stadium as we know it now. The team improved, the team started winning trophies, and success begets success, doesn't it? And I think that, Queen's Park's failure to, because Queen's Park up until that point were the most successful club in Scotland by far, but they were left behind by the failure to, and willingly left behind by the failure to embrace professionalism. They wanted to stay amateur, and I think that created a vacuum that Rangers, by dint of their organisation and by dint of the work that they had done behind the scenes over the years, meant that they were in a position to take that role as the prominent club in Scotland.
Yeah, again, I think the biggest thing about the whole story about that book and what went on back then. It was four boys, soon to be five, that were teenagers. And when I walk up those marble staircases, which I'm not the pleasure of the honour doing for a while, but hopefully that can return. When I stand at the top and I start seeing the paintings, and I think, they turned into this. And you stand at the top of the marble staircases, and if you don't get it, you know, the hairs, I've worked in the building and went up those stairs almost every day, and every day you get the same feeling of pride and the goosebumps and the hairs. They were 15, and it became this to get from there 150 years later to where this club is now. And I think the first 25, 30 years were what made sure it was a success. So the work that went into that and that drive is just, it's a phenomenal story.
One of the things that I would love to have discovered is that the Marquess of Lorne, the Duke of Argyll, became a patron of Rangers very early on, 1873, 1874. And that was not unusual because there was a kind of benevolence that came with the patriarchs at that time, particularly around the clan system. So he would have seen, and I think he gave money to various clubs. It was just part of his role as this kind of clan chief to support, if you like, Manly. And they were Manly at the time, because very few, if any, women involved in sport. These Manly endeavours, shinty, football, whatever it may well be, athletics. And he gifted Rangers a couple of pounds. And I got in touch with the Duke of Argyll and the archivist to see if it'd be possible to go up to Inverary just to have a look at his archives. And the word came back that it was, wasn't possible because nothing had been collated, nothing had been pulled together, nothing had been organised. So I still think that there's gaps. So, you know, I would love to have found, I would love to think that somewhere there's a letter from the from probably be Peter McNeill to the to the Duke of Argyll asking him, Marcus Allon, saying, look, can we, you know, will you be our honorary president? Will you be our honorary secretary? And nudge, nudge, wink, wink. That means sending us a couple of quid to get started, which he did. You know, so that link between Rangers and royalty is very much established from the very first. I mean, the Duke of Argyll was married to Louise, who's Queen Victoria's daughter. You know, she lived up in Rosneath up until her death in the early 30s. You know, Lake Louise in Canada is named after her. Yes, yeah, named after it's named after the Duke of Argyll, because he was the first governor of Canada. Went over there in the 1860s, 1870s, I think it was. So there's kind of links with the royal family and the kind of royalty and the establishment, if you want to go that way, from the very early days of Rangers. So you had these boys starting a club for nothing other than reasons of altruism. They just wanted to play football, you know. But they began to get good people around them. They began to attract, you know, the benevolent supporters that would help them grow despite the mishaps of the early 1880s when they took their eye off the ball and had to be bailed out by George Goudie. It's a great story.
Is it any wonder, because they were still kids?
Peter Campbell dies sadly in about 1883. William Macbeth heads off very shortly. Peter and Moses is there, but Moses is more of a football player than he is an administrator, so he kind of disappears off the scene in the late 1870s, early 1880s as well. You know, but others come to the fore as well. You know, and in years to come, it would be people at William Wilton that would take the mantle, people at George Goudie. So, you know, they have this brilliant ability to reinvent themselves and to attract fresh blood that would keep the club on the upward spiral. And never ever underestimate, as I said earlier on, the influence of Tom Valance. You know, he was a colossus on the field and off.
So what happens next? I mean, the book, chronologically, what's that year does that end?
The book is I thought that there was nothing to be gained beyond taking the book beyond about 1899, the move to the first Ibrox. Thereafter, it becomes just a, you know, just as you said, and then in 1904, and then in 1905. So I think the book sits as it sits. And maybe in years to come, there will be new nuggets of information that come and new things that are revealed and new things that bear witness to what may have happened back in 1872 or and going into 1873 that would force a rewrite. But just now, the 150th anniversary edition is probably, in terms of the history of Rangers, early years history of Rangers, is as complete as I think it can be. It's the book of which I'm proudest. It's the book of which I'm happiest. It's the book which I think is best written. It's the book I think has got the most pertinent and the right information in it as well. And I think that it sits, I hope rather, that it sits as a testament to the five boys, that it helps to bring their story to life. And I hope that for Rangers fans, if they pick it up and they have a look at it, it maybe just serves as a wee reminder that of the very, very humble origins of the club. It really did come from nothing.
I've just been thinking about something there, and this often happens to me when I'm doing these podcasts, so bear with me. I done something in 2012 that I'd never planned in my life, and often said to myself, why the hell did I do it? And I think, I'm not saying it's the thing, right? But it's certainly probably the story I told you earlier, but I had that book and never read it for a while. And it probably wasn't long before the formation of Sons of Struth that I actually read that book. Now, it is possible that if I hadn't read that book, I might not have had as much inspiration, because the thing that sunk into me was they were boys. That was a big thing for me, and it became this thing. So that book's probably had a bigger influence in that part of my life, or after that part of it, than I probably ever actually thought about until we were sitting talking about, because I must have got that book about 2009-10, and I probably no read it till 11-12. And then I never read it after Sons of Truth was formed. So I must have read it in the sort of window the year before.
It's really, really kind of you to say that. I think that, you know, we've seen in recent years the popularity of programs such as Who Do You Think You Are, etc., etc. And there was a degree of that in this as well, you know, going back and going through the dusty archives. I think that in 2023 or 2009, even the 10, 15 years that it's been published, we live in such a fast-paced society. Nothing stays the same for very, very long. You know, the media is constantly evolving and changing. Stories are constantly evolving and changing. You know, you get 20-second sound bites about Andy Halliday's girl, and then 20-second sound bites about another wag who's, you know, ordered a Starbucks, right? It's so, I think that people look for a bit of certainty and a bit of comfort in the things around the things that mean most to them in their lives. And the bottom line is, understandably, Rangers mean so very much to so very, very, very many people. And Rangers fans came close to losing their club. And if it hadn't been for the efforts of yourself and Bomber and, you know, many others, but not too many others, Dave King, Douglas Park, John Bennett, all these guys, George Latham, you know, they might not have had a club to support. And so I think that having this book in some way, shape or form just reminds Rangers fans, I hope, of just where the club came from, you know, and just the spirit and the endeavour and the enthusiasm and the entrepreneurial skill that these kids had to show, in addition for most of them being great footballers, to form a club that would last beyond the 6 months or the 12 months that most of them did at that time. And I think there's something comforting in a world that can be chaotic for people at times to have a book like this to reflect back on at a different time, but just to acknowledge just where their club has come from.
Yeah, it's an incredible book, and as I say, I think I probably owe you a fair bit of credit for inspiring me, because I've ever thought about it before. Chronologically, you wrote that book, came out in 2009, we'd have probably got it as Christmas presents 9 or 10. As I say, I'd done that, no, for me. I didn't read it after the formation of Sons of Struth, so it must have been in that window, probably 11 to 12. And it probably did drive me. If I hadn't read that book, would I have done, I don't know,
here's
Sliding
a
Doors?
Here's a question. I think Charles Green read it.
Craig, I don't think so.
Do you think Craig White read it?
I wouldn't have thought so.
A mate of mine's had to go and get an interview with White for the foreword to the official History of Rangers book that came out in 2012. And he came back and I says to him, How'd you get on? He says, charlatan. Couldn't he spell Rangers and knows nothing about them?
No, they wouldn't have read it. Well, Gary, I can't thank you enough. Again, you've got a man with an interesting career, and that's the type of people I like to talk to, because there's always stories behind the stories. So I can't thank you enough for your time today. Before we finish up, is there anything you want to add? Anything that you hadn't spoke about that you wanted to?
No, everything's fine. Appreciate it, Craig. Thanks very much.
You had fun.
I wander down memory lane and I tell you what a meander it was. It was like Davy Cooper on the left wing, eh? In and out. And hopefully there's an end delivery as well.
Awesome. Thanks, you know.
Thanks, Craig. All the best.
Cheers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing.
Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.